in the lecture today, I think we see a way in which Rothbard's history of economic thought is very different from most histories of economic thought that you might come across, in that a great deal of the chapters that we read today isn't directly about economics. One of the things Rothbard is doing is giving a general picture of the period, not confining himself to economic theory. And in the lecture today, we're going to be even more so than in some of the other chapters. So you can certainly learn a lot about European history and intellectual movement. You'll be learning about economics as well, but a lot of the material we have is not directly on economics. And why is that? I mean, obviously Rothbard, if he wanted to, could have written a history of Western thought or history of thought in Europe, but why did he put all this in a book on economics? It reminds me of an incident once happened when I was in ninth grade, which was a very long time ago. In my math class, the teacher had us for the last few weeks studying architecture, and we had to make an architecture notebook. And one of the people in the class, he was kind of a class clown, put up his hand and said, if this is a math class, why are we studying architecture? So you might have an analogous question when you're reading these chapters. And the point to realize is that Rothbard didn't think that the history of economics was self-contained. He didn't think that all that's involved in economics is, say, one writer about economics responding to what some other writer about economics has said, so that it just be kind of a purely theoretical development within economics. To the contrary, he thought that economics was influenced by general cultural and intellectual developments at the time, and in turn, economics influenced those developments. It was kind of a mutual interpenetration between economics and other subjects. You can't, if you want to study history of economics, you can't just study economics in isolation. But given that general point that economics is not self-contained, that we can't study economics just as kind of a pure theory of economics isolated from all other developments, we would still have a question, why does Rothbard stress religion so much? Talks a great deal about the Protestant Reformation, Catholicism, Lutheranism, Calvinism. Why is he talking about religion so much in this book? And I think the answer is we'll see something that's fundamentally important in Rothbard's thinking. If religion is a key part of a fundamental polarity, a division that animates the book. I think we can see in this volume there's a fundamental division. And if I say religion helps us, is a key part of this fundamental polarity of division. What is this polarity that I'm talking about? Well, you remember I mentioned in the previous lecture, there is a key antithesis, a key opposition that Rothbard finds in the history of economic thought between subjectivist theories of value, that's to say, theories that say the value of goods, the value of commodities depends on their subjective utility. Say the value of an apple, or the price of an apple, will depend on people's preferences for apples as against their preferences for other things. And against this subjectivist theory of value, there's a contrasting view an objective school of value theory. And this theory says the value of a good is not determined by its utility or not principally by its utility to people, but by its cost of production. Now, Rothbard doesn't make any bones about which side he's on. Subjectivist theory is the correct one, and the objective cost reduction theories are the wrong one. So he's trying, first have to realize, within economic theory, there's this basic division. So then we have to ask, well, how does religion and these other cultural developments come into this? How does this play a part, if religion play a part in this key antithesis between the subjectivist theories of value that say values depend on utility and people's preferences, and the cost of production theory that say value depends on an objective phenomenon, namely how much the thing costs to produce. Now, Rothbard associates both subjective and objective theories of value with various other phenomena. So he's saying, as I said before, it isn't just we have a kind of pure development in theory, in economic theory. We have, in his view, each basic kind of theory, the subjectivist and the objectivist theory, they're associated with other things. Now, a subjectivist theory are associated first with an emphasis on consumption. Say, when you're talking about people's preferences or utility, well, what are these preferences or utility, what are these preferences for? They're ultimately preferences for using the good, preferences for consuming the good. Of course, we have producers who have preferences for goods also, but ultimately, they're, when you're producing something, it's for the purpose of consumption. So you would value something, means of production, will ultimately be traceable to consumers' valuations for what they want. And producers' goods are valuable because they will enable you, if you have them, to produce consumption goods. So basically, consumption is primary. Now, Rothbard also associates this subjectivist theory with belief in the power of reason. People who believed in reason, in his view, would tend to be attracted to subjectivist theories. And this is probably because he thinks that that's the correct theory. So if you're believing in reason, then you would tend to be attracted to subjectivist theory. And also, it's not just sort of a quasi-logical connection, but he thinks that's in fact the way it worked out. The people who did believe in the power of reason tended to be attracted to subjectivist theory. And he also associates this with Catholicism. Rothbard, as you may know, was not religious believer, but you'll find unmistakably, he liked the Catholic Church, especially in the medieval and Renaissance period. He was a great admirer of the Catholic Church. And one of the reasons he admired the Catholic Church, he said, well, the Catholic Church believed in reason. They believed in natural law. They didn't, although, of course, the Catholic Church is a Christian church, they believe in divine revelation, they allowed a place for reason, and they didn't say that human reason is impotent and that we have to accept everything on faith. They would, especially in the same philosophy of Aquinas or the other classic, we have a great emphasis on reason. So we have first with the subjectivist theory, we're emphasizing both emphasis on consumption, belief in the power of reason, and Catholicism. Now, if you take the contrasting type of value theory, the cost reduction theory, Rothbard thinks these theories go together with abstinence from consumption. Say if you, again, it's not a strictly logical connection, but he thinks if you think that the value of goods determined by cost of production, then you'll tend to emphasize, when you're thinking about human life, human virtue, you'll tend to emphasize production rather than consumption. This will be kind of an elective affinity with that kind of value theory. If you're stressing production, then you're going to say, well, what you should be doing in your life really is producing things. You shouldn't concentrate on consumption, pleasure, and trying to enjoy the good life. You should be working hard. So that, he thinks, goes together with cost reduction theory. He also thinks that what goes together with cost reduction theory is skepticism about reason. And I think the reason he thinks this is he thinks it's just his close historical connection that people who believed in cost reduction theory and emphasized hard work tended to be ones who downplayed what human reason could achieve. The people who believed in human reason tended to emphasize consumption more. Now you might say, well, there's no logical connection there. And Rothbard didn't think that there was, but he said, in fact, these sets of phenomena that one sees the limited tend to go with each other. People who are skeptical about reason will tend to emphasize production. And who were the ones who were skeptical about reason? Well, as we'll see very shortly, he thought these were mainly the Protestants rather than the Catholics. Now, they say Rothbard did not think these associations, these ones I've just been going through, are logically necessary. He just said, if we look at history, the history of the period, we'll find that if we bear these associations in mind, we'll have a good way of understanding what's going on. Now, this view that Protestantism is associated with irrationalism, with denying the ability of reason, it colors his view of Martin Luther and John Calvin, the two greatest of the figures of the Protestant Reformation. I should say, what we're doing in this lecture, we're giving an account of Rothbard's interpretation of it. Not everybody accepts this view of Luther and Calvin. There are some people who take either or both of them to have different views from the one Rothbard ascribes to them, but this is his interpretation of them, that he said they're irrationalists. They say in their view, both Luther and Calvin held this, according to Robert, human reason had been corrupted by original sin. Remember, the Christian doctrine is that Adam and Eve sinned by disobeying God's will, and as a result, they were cast out of the Garden of Eden. Well, in the Protestant view, this has really affected human reason. We're unable, really, to our reason has been dealt a very strong blow by original sin. So we can't have a natural law ethics. We have to rely on faith. And what Rothbard says here, I just want to give this quotation. Wait, I see somebody's made a comment here. Somebody said, I don't believe in God, but I believe that Mary was his mother. Oh, yes, that's from Santillana. Yeah, that wasn't Rothbard who said that. Yes, I think it's not clear Santillana said that he said something like that. But anyway, so let's look at what Rothbard says. He said, if reason cannot be used to frame an ethic, This means that Luther and Calvin had to, in essence, throw out natural law. And in doing so, they jettisoned the basic criteria developed over the centuries by which to criticize the despotic actions of the state. Indeed, Luther and Calvin, relying on isolated biblical passages rather than on an integrated philosophical tradition, opined that the powers that be are ordained of God. Now remember, just interrupting the quotation, where does that sentence come from, the powers that be are ordained of God? Anybody tell me that? And it's not from Santayana. Does anybody know, where does that come from, powers that be are ordained of God? Well, it's from Romans 13 in the New Testament. It says, upon the powers that be ordained of God, and therefore the king, no matter how tyrannical, is divinely appointed and must always be obeyed. So here, we get a key to what Rockhart is doing in the two chapters I asked you to read for today's lecture. What Rockhart is doing, principally, is explaining how the absolute state arose, and then we're going to see in subsequent lectures that how the mercantilist mercantilist approach to economics fitted in with the absolute state. So the state became much more powerful than in the Middle Ages. The state was limited by natural law, and the church was very powerful. So the state couldn't do, the king couldn't do whatever he wanted. But in this period we're concerned with, this lecture, 16th, 17th century, things were changing. The state was getting much more powerful. So Rothbard is concerned with Luther and Calvin because he said, well, what they did was to get rid of natural law. So by doing that, they're loosening the restraints on the state. So they're really allied with secular ideologists that we'll be discussing later. People were just defending the state power for its own sake. So he said Luther and Calvin, from a religious point of view, were helping to the state to grow in power because they were, by getting rid of natural law, they're saying that there aren't restraints on the power of the king. And he thinks they're taking from the Bible that you have to obey the king, the powers that be ordained of God. And you say this is a controversial interpretation of Luther and Calvin, but this is the one he strongly holds to. Now, what about economics and the great Protestant reformers? Luther's ideas on economics were confused. Sometimes say he was against usury, taking interest. Other times he defends it, says, well, we have to accept it. But he really didn't think economics was very important. He thought people were really wasting their time when they're spending too much time thinking about economics. Now, why was that? Well, he thought that the secular world, kind of the everyday world that we live in, was very sharply separated from the kingdom of God. It really, the Christian believer was really living in two kingdoms. It was the kingdom of God and the secular world. They were separated. So what was really important to the believer was what was going on in the kingdom of God. In the secular realm, really the main thing that the ruler had to do was to suppress disorder. Remember, because of original sin, people were going to have a tendency to do evil, so it's very important that the prince really clamp down on any revolt. Remember, in the peasants' revolt, in the 1520s, Luther came very strongly down against the peasants. He didn't like revolts. He's like, look, disorder is a very bad thing. We can't have any real great achievements in the secular world. All that we can hope for is to suppress disorder, and the really essential thing for what's going on in the kingdom of God. So Rothbard points out this view that what's really important in the kingdom of God played into the hands of the secular princes because they were anxious to increase their own power. Say the Protestant princes would confiscate the lands owned by the monks, and they would church property. So they'd say, well, and Luther would say, what's going on in these really physical buildings isn't really essential to the kingdom of God. So that's really playing into the hands of secular princes. Luther says, well, remember, the ruler has been ordained by God, so you have to do what he says. As I mentioned, the view of Luther that Rothbard is adopting is a controversial one. And the view that he's taking is very much associated with conservative Catholic writers on Luther. I just mentioned two of the most famous, Heinrich the Niefler, Hartmann Grisar. These are people who really have stressed Luther as an irrationalist. There are people, say, on the other side who say, no, he was really following certain developments in scholastic philosophy, especially from the nominalists. But Rothbard takes this view. He's very much influenced by the conservative Catholic writers. If you want another book along the line, you might look at the book by Jacques Maritain called Three Reformers. The chapter on Luther would give a view of Luther as an irrationalist, very much along the lines that Rothbard has suggested. Now, on Calvin had was somewhat more interested in economics than Luther. Although, remember, Rothbard takes Calvin to be an irrationalist, someone who said, we're totally corrupted by original sin, so we can't rely on reason, we have to rely on faith. Now, despite his low opinion of Calvin, Rothbard, I have a very bad pun here, which I won't repeat, he said that that Calvin really got rid of the usury prohibition, at least in theory. Remember, what we've seen, especially in the last lecture, some of the Catholic scholastics like Lessius and Asclepiotr, others were saying, well, we have a prohibition of taking interest in church law, but there are various ways we can get around it. Remember, we talked about lucrum sessans, which is lost profit, or we would have the risk that your money would be lost. You can take a compensation for that. There were various schemes to get around taking interest. But what Calvin said was, he broke with that. He said, really, there's nothing really wrong with interest. There's nothing wrong with usury. And the main argument, one of the main arguments have been given that something's wrong with interest. Remember, Aristotle said that money is barren. Aristotle said, the way scholastics interpreted him was saying, well, if you just lend somebody money, then if you take the money, it's not going to grow into more money. If you build some tools, you can use that to produce something more, but if you just have money, it's not going to do anything. So Calvin answered, well, that may be true if you just, say, put the money away and just let it lie there, but if you invest it, you will be producing something. It just depends on what you're going to do with it. So this argument really isn't a very good one that Aristotle said. He said, money is barren. So Calvin said, no, it isn't fair, and it depends what you're using it for. Now, there's a way, though, in which Calvin is reversed the Catholic approach to interest. Remember, I said that the Scholastics said, well, interest is wrong, usury is prohibitive, but there are all these interesting ways we can get around that prohibition. There are these loopholes, there are these exceptions. There's a story about the comedian W.C. Fields, I think it is, when he was on his deathbed, he was reading the Bible, and he had never been a religious person, so someone said, why are you reading the Bible? He said, looking for loopholes. But see, this is what the Catholics were doing. They were trying to say interest is prohibited, but we can get their ways, we can allow interest. Now, Calvin was the reverse of this, because he said interest is all right, but in practice he was wanting to impose restrictions on it, especially, say, lending to the poor and the rate of interest you could charge. So he was saying interest is all right in theory, but not in practice. In practice it was pretty limited. The reverse of the Catholics, who said interest is wrong, but there are exceptions that allow you to take interest. So it's a very different approach. Now, some of the Calvinists developed these views further. And one of the most interesting ones was the great Dutch classical scholar Claudius Salmasius, who lived from 1588 to 1653. He was a famous biblical scholar, and he was a very contentious person. He would always get into fights with people. Now, one thing I put in here, there's a famous, for those of you who study English literature, may be familiar with Salmasius, because the great British poet John Milton launched a very famous and vituperative attack on Salmasius, because Salmasius had written a defense of absolute monarchy, an attack on the English church government under the Puritans, the independent churches. He'd written an attack on this, and Milton replied to him. And I just put in, because I thought you might find it interesting to read. Milton was quite a controversialist. I just put a sample of what he says here. He says, she, meaning France, is right by my trust. She is right and can willingly allow you, you French capon, with your mankind wife. Now here, that was a reference. He was making fun of Salmasius, his wife, like it was a rich heiress who wasn't particularly good looking. With your mankind wife, your guest chock full of emptiness, to wander about till somewhere in creation you light upon a dole bountiful enough for a grammarian, cavalier, illustrious hypocritic. So he's saying he's a hypocrite. He's known as a critic, so we kind of call him a hypocritic. Always supposing any king or state has a mind to bid highest for a vagabond pedant that is on sale. I see, if you say my book reviews are bad, you should look at what Milton is saying. Milton was very tough on people. If you're interested in Milton, you should look at his poem. It begins, "Avenge, O Lord, thy slaughtered saint." So, as I say, for those of you in taking in English literature, you may have heard of Salmasius. Now, what was Salmasius' contribution on taking interest? Well, he was really, up to the point, he was the most radical defender of the morality of interest taking. And even some of those who were sympathetic to interest really criticized money lending on consumption loans to the poor. I mean, we still find that today. You'll find people attacking payroll loans, say when poor people need money right away, so they go to these special places they can get a loan on their coming payroll check. They'll get some cash right away, but they have to pay very high rate of interest. So even today, people attack that and they want to pass laws against it. But Salmasius said, what's supposed to be so bad about money lending? Why is this supposed to be a bad thing in the first place? Why isn't it just a business like any other, just like people have, say, for any other service? Why isn't providing money for people when they want a service? Why should we suppose there's some kind of special morality governing money lending that makes this a bad thing as opposed to other kinds of businesses? Now, suppose somebody said to him, well, look, just like the example I gave today with the payroll loan, aren't the poor victims of high interest rates because these people who are giving money know that they really need the money right away, so they can charge them very high rates. Aren't they taking advantage of these poor people? So maybe said, well, if you think that, then you certainly shouldn't have laws prohibiting money lending, because if you have more money lenders, if you don't have laws prohibiting them, there'll be more of them, then the competition will lower interest rates. So if you want to have lower interest rates so that the poor won't suffer, then you should favor more money lending. Now, this kind of argument is a kind that Mises later used, not specifically on interest, but Mises very often did. Those of you who studied his writings will know this kind of argument. You'll say, on various kinds of government interventions like minimum wage laws, say, look, you people who favor this think these laws will achieve a good end, like minimum wage laws will help the poor workers, but in fact it won't. It'll have the opposite result from the ones you want. Minimum wage laws will cause unemployment. So Salmasius is giving an argument like the type Mises had later, saying you want to help the poor because you think the poor are victimized by high interest rates. Well, if you think that, you shouldn't favor laws against money lenders, because if you have more money lenders, that'll lower interest rates and help the poor. Now, we're still on the Calvinists. Now, there's an important concept that Calvin had, and Luther also, Calvin is the one who really stressed this, that plays is significant, and we'll see why for economics, we'll see why it's significant in a short while, but first I want to explain the concept. And what Calvin stressed is that people were called by God to work in their job. So you should look at the job you have, not simply say is something you do in order to get money so you can buy things for yourself, but your job was really the mission that God had given you. It was something really sacred in your job, that you were doing God's work. And in the Middle Ages, the view was that only those in the priesthood were called, especially those who were monks, those who were completely apart from the world, but other priests as well. They were the ones who were called by God, and the people in ordinary life were just working, say, because that would be something that would enable them to live, but they didn't, in the Middle Ages, they didn't stress that people in these secular occupations if you're in a job, say you're working, you're a farmer, you're working to do God's will. So remember, one of the doctrines of the Protestant Reformation was called the priesthood of all believers. So just as priests are called in the Calvinist, to some extent Lutheran view, everybody is called, you're doing God's work. So, well, what happens if you take that view, that the work that you're doing is really God's work. But what if you do well? If you were prosperous, at least some Calvinists said that was a sign you're one of the elect. Now, what do we mean by the elect? Well, in the Calvinist view, also the Lutheran view, that God decides which people are going to be saved, which people go to heaven. So these people are predestined to salvation. And nobody knows, say, while you're on earth, whether you're one of these people, whether you're in the elect. But if you did well in your occupation, you were fulfilling the job that God had called you to, then you could take that as a sign that you were one of the elect. So this would encourage people who believe that to do well, because they could say, well, if we work hard and then we're prosperous, this is a sign that we're one of the elect. Now, the great German sociologist Max Weber, who was incidentally a friend of Ludwig von Mises, he knew Mises because he taught in the University of Vienna for a while, and I think that was where he met Mises. And so he, in his interpretation of the origins of capitalism, he placed a great deal of emphasis on this notion of the calling, especially among the Puritans. And remember, some of you may have read his famous book on this subject called The Protestant Ethic in the Spirit of Capitalism. So what Weber's basic way of looking at origin of capitalism said, well, look, if we look at throughout history, we very frequently find trading, people having exchanges, people accumulating wealth. We have rich people in all sorts of societies throughout history. We have people engaged in trade, groups who are very good at trade or specializing in trade. But trade and accumulating wealth isn't sufficient for capitalism. Capitalism, as we have it today, is a different system, because under capitalism, people don't just accumulate so they can be enormously wealthy personally. There were famous, very famous wealthy people in classical antiquity. But in capitalism, what's important is not that people accumulate money so they can be personally wealthy, but they save money and accumulate so they can accumulate large amounts of capital goods so they can increase production. So what Weber emphasized was just this notion of the calling. What would encourage people to keep working hard and accumulate money so they could just produce, get more and more production goods rather than consume it personally. He said people would have to be dominated by what he called innerworldly asceticism. What do you mean by that? Well, you know, think of monks, you know, people or hermits, people go out into the isolated and go through various, give up things and go through various practices to discipline themselves because they think God wants them to do that, or that's a way they can show their closeness to God. So Weber said, well, people who have this notion of calling and think you can do that, you can be devoted to God and discipline yourself within the world. You can be ascetics within the world, and you would do that by saving and accumulating. So this is one basic way Weber distinguished between ordinary trading, which is common in history, and capitalism, the system that we have contemporary with when he was writing in the late 19th and early 20th century. Now, Rothbard, as you might expect, doesn't accept the vague receivers. He rejects that. And you can see why the tension rejects. Remember, I said before, Rothbard tends to be quite critical of the Protestant reformers. Said, no, they really are rationalists. They paved the way for state absolutism by denying the power of reason and by saying we have to obey the king. So he isn't inclined to say, well, it's really the Protestants, the notion of calling, just by the Protestants, that explains the origins of capitalism. And he points out against Weber that capitalism didn't begin with the Calvinists that Weber had stressed. It began in Catholic areas, especially towns in Italy in the Middle Ages. If Weber were right, well, wouldn't we find capitalism in beginning in the Calvinist areas or the Lutheran areas? But he said, Rafa said, no, that wasn't the way it didn't play out that way. It began in Catholic areas. But what about the point that Weber raises? Well, isn't there a difference between wanting to be rich just so you can have a high standard of living, so you can live in a palace and have all the jewels you want, and the notion we have capitalism where you're accumulating wealth so you can keep increasing production? Don't you have to restrict consumption to do that? And if you do that, wouldn't you be, one way that you would do that is if you're influenced by this notion of the calling in the asceticism. Well, Ralph said that may be for some Protestants, but you find there's some Catholics like Jakob Fugger, who was a very famous banker at the time, the most famous banker. He was a Catholic, but he had just these Protestant virtues that Weber was talking about. He said, well, he just wants to keep working. He's not going to stop it. Isn't consumption, just can't stop working. So you find Catholics who have the attitude that Weber thought were quintessentially Protestant. Now, although Rothbard rejects the connection that Weber drew between Calvinism, it's just on the calling and the origin of capitalism, he does think that there's a connection between Calvinism and economic theory. And this I mentioned a little bit at the beginning of the lecture. He follows Emil Cowder, who is a writer who wrote a great deal on the history of marginal utility theory. He was an Austrian writer, someone from Austria, who was very interested in origins of utility theory. He followed Emil Cowder in thinking the Calvinist stress on hard work led to a glorification of labor. If you're stressing hard work, then you're going to think labor is extremely important. You think labor is really a great thing. And it would also lead to cost of production theories of value. You think, well, if hard work is that important, then the value of a good would depend on how much of this hard work is put into it. And in contrast, the Catholics tended to stress more a balance between consumption and production. They didn't say production is not important. Of course it is, but they said we have to balance consumption and production. And here, remember, the Catholics, at least the Scholastics, were Aristotelians. They were followers of Aristotle, who stressed moderation. We shouldn't just glorify labor, forget about consumption. We have to be moderate both in consumption and production. And this, Rothbard thinks, led to a subjectivist theories of value. Now, getting to a more particular aspect of economic theory, what we've been doing so far is this kind of general background in intellectual history, so one's connection with religion and economics, and we've dealt somewhat with morality in economics might say is interest moral, but there are things going on in actual economic theory in this period, hard as that might have been to believe from what was said earlier in the lecture. And one important thing that happened in economic theory was from the great astronomer Nicholas Copernicus, who lived from 1473 to 1543. Here, Rothbard modifies the claim he made in an earlier chapter, and I discussed this last time. Remember, in the earlier chapter, he said that the quantity theory of money, the view that increases in, if the amount of money in circulation increases, prices will go up. He said the one who has credit for that is Aspilqueta, not Jean Baudin. Jean Baudin had read Aspilqueta. But here he said, well, even before Aspilqueta, Copernicus had this insight that if you increase the quantity of money, then this will be the main cause of rising price. And he thinks Copernicus gets extra credit for coming up with this because when Aspilqueta was writing, he was familiar with the vast amount of gold and silver that was coming in from the Spanish America, so he could see when prices were going up, so he would have a pretty good idea of the idea would suggest itself to him that there's some connection between these two phenomena, that the precious metals are coming into the country and prices are rising. But he said, Robert said, well, Copernicus, when he wrote about this in 1526, this is before this influx of metals, and he wasn't aware of that, but he still figured this out just by thinking about things. Now, another insight of Copernicus in economics is what's called Gresham's Law. Now, one person we didn't discuss who was a very important figure comes in early was Nicholas O'Rane, who came up with this in the 14th century. So Gresham's Law, which Copernicus had, Sir Thomas Gresham lived during the Elizabethan period in England, but the law is that money that the state overvalues will drive out money undervalued by the state. For example, let's say we start off with gold coins, and let's say some of these coins get worn out, some of the gold wears off, so say they lose 10% of the gold. Well, in a free market, the coins that have been worn off won't be equivalent to the coins that are completely new gold. If you want to get a newly minted coin that's just a gold coin, you couldn't say, well, I'll give you one of these worn out coins of the same amount, let's exchange that. That wouldn't be the way it would work in a free market. You'd have to give more of the worn out coins to get one of the coins that wasn't worn out. But suppose the state says you have to exchange them at the same rate. Well, what the state would be doing, they'd be imposing price control. They'd say the prices of the good coins can't rise above a certain point. So what happens when you have maximum prices? Well, there's a shortage. There'll be more of the gold coins, good coins demanded than people who have them will supply, because if you have these gold coins, you're not going to want to trade them for the same amount of the bad coins, the base coins, the worn out ones. So the good coins will be hoarded or melted down or exported. They'll be driven out of circulation. So sometimes people will state this law, Gresham's Law, bad money drives out good. But that isn't true on the free market, because on the free market, the worn down coins wouldn't exchange the same price as coins that were full metal content, so that the good coins wouldn't be driven out. It's just when you have these monies in circulation, when the state sets the exchange rate that's overvaluing one money and undervaluing the other, then the money that's undervalued will be driven out. And Copernicus had this fundamental insight. Now, not all developments in economic theory were good ones. Remember, we said this right at the first lecture. Rothbard doesn't take this completely, this Whig theory where there's constant progress. There's a kind of battle between the good and the bad theories. And one of the mistaken views, which was what Rothbard considered a mistaken view, which was one that Thomas Malthus made famous in 1798, is the law of population. And just as Copernicus anticipated in some of the later quantity theory of money, this bad theory of the law of population was anticipated by Italian writer Giovanni Botero, who lived from 1540-1570. And he came up with this law of population in 1588. And he said that population tends to grow without limit, but the growth in food is limited. So as population presses on subsistence on food, then it will be checked by wars, famine, or plague, because population can't just keep increasing. People don't have anything to live on, so people are going to die in some way or the other. Or, on the one hand, these are having checks to population, wars, famine, or plague. Or on the other hand, people are just designed to have fewer children. And this is exactly what Malthus said in 1798, and afterwards, Malthus's essay on population went through a number of editions. Now, Rothbard doesn't accept this law of population, and here he's following the great economist Joseph Schumpeter, and he says that the basic problem is this theory is taking the same, well, population is growing on the one hand, food production is growing on the other hand, that population is growing faster than the food, so then there's going to be problems. But this is taking population food supply really as independent things. They're saying one is growing at one rate, one is growing at the other rate. But he says, in fact, well, Schumpeter and Rothbard say, in fact, they're interdependent. It isn't that just one is growing at a certain rate, the other is growing at a different rate. The rate that population grows will be dependent on how food production is going, because people will be aware when they're deciding whether to have children on what the food is going to be available to feed those children. It isn't that people are just going to just keep having children just kind of blindly, and then they'll find out, oh, there isn't enough food. They'll be aware of this interplay between food supply and population. They'll say, well, if we want to have children, we're going to have make sure there's enough food for them. If we can ensure that, then maybe we won't have the children. And Rothbard, I think, is very good at asking critical questions about this. He says, well, if according to this theory, people can check the growth of population in extreme circumstances in the period of Malthus and Voltaire, if people are faced by famine, then they could say, well, maybe we should not have children, or not have as many children. Why can't they do this at other times? Why is it just in the extreme cases that we're supposed to be able to come up with this check to population? Now, we now come with another mistaken idea, and this is from the great French essayist Michel de Montaigne. Rothbard has a very good footnote. You should look this up if you haven't seen it already, on how the last name should be pronounced. Now, I see Danny said, didn't need to say it was kernel truth in Malthus' law of population, it was a special case of law of return. Yes, he does say that there's a particular population that is sort of the optimum amount given the other factors. Reduction, you're right, that is an application of law of returns, but that's not a contradiction to what Rothbard is saying, because Rothbard isn't saying there isn't an optimum population. What Rothbard is questioning is just that people really, there'll be kind of this blind movement of population to grow automatically unless and it will get much more than food supply, and then it will only be when people are faced with these extreme circumstances that population will decline. So you could say, so what Rothbard is saying is perfectly consistent with that aspect of Malthus, it's just denying this kind of causal independence of population and food supply. That's a good question. A good point you raised. So Montaigne was responsible for another mistaken economic idea. What he said was that in trade, especially in international trade, one party benefits at the expense of another. Now, those of you who take no Austrian economics will know one of the most basic points is you wouldn't make an exchange with somebody else. Exchange wouldn't take place unless both parties expect to benefit. So it isn't that, as Rothbard points out, in the Middle Ages people realize this, the Scholastics realize that trade takes place because people benefit from it. But Montaigne went against this. He said, no, in trade one person was getting the better of the other person, so the French state should try to grab as much as it can. And one way he fell into this fallacy, Mises calls this the Montaigne fallacy, this view that trade benefits one party at the expense of the other. We saw that trade will depend on the needs of others. For example, suppose someone's a doctor, well, he's dependent on other people getting sick. So you can jump from that to thinking, well, he's benefiting because other people are badly off. So that's one way you could come up with this wrong view that trade takes advantage of other people. But the fallacy here is to think that trade creates the needs. That, say, it isn't that the doctor is making us sick, it's that he's helping us when we get sick. He's going to try to make us better. You know, there's an old joke. Someone says, no wonder the undertaker is doing so, business is going so well for the undertaker. His office is right next to the doctor. So that joke is really expressing the fallacy Montaigne fell into, because trade is responding to me that trade is really creating these deficiencies or needs. Now, Montaigne, we haven't gotten rid of all his problems. He was a philosophical skeptic. He said, this is Rothbard's summary of his view, he said, man can know nothing, his reason being insufficient to arrive either at a natural law, ethics, or a firm theology. As Montaigne put it, reason does nothing but go astray in everything, and especially when it meddles with divine things. And for a while, Montaigne adopted his official motto, the query, what do I know? But now, here we get to a key theme in Rothbard's thinking and his view of philosophy. The skeptical view, the view that we don't know anything, led Montaigne to defend obedience to the government in all matters, because what he thought was, well, we don't know enough to challenge the government's authority. And I suppose the government says you have to do such and such. Well, even if we don't think it doesn't seem like such a good thing to us, we don't know enough to challenge what the government has said. So a key theme in Rothbard is that this skeptical view that we really should be unsure that we know anything does not lead to tolerance and freedom, but he thinks it leads to obeying the government. So you probably found people, commentaries who studied Mises and Rothbard, they're critics who say Mises and Rothbard are very dogmatic because they say economic laws are known a priori. I say we can know certain laws of economics just by thinking about it. So these critics say, well, doesn't that lead to intolerance because you say, I know this to be true, it's self-evident that this is the correct, or it's self-evident, it follows from a self-evident principle. These are the truths about economics. So if you don't accept those truths, then you're wrong, and so we can go in take action against you. So Rothbard said, no, that isn't right. And in fact, the other way around, that skepticism can't offer resistance to absolutism. Now, Montaigne was just one of many in the 16th century who defended the absolute power of the state. Montaigne was taking the steps and he said, we don't know anything, so we have to do whatever the state tells us. A humanist, who were people who studied the Latin and Greek classics, shifted in the 16th century from an earlier stress on human excellence, people like, who were saying that the early humans were saying human beings should develop their intellectual powers, and remember the Pico's oration on the dignity of man. Now these later humanists tended to say, instead of emphasizing the dignity of man, they emphasized the glory of the king. For example, in France, Guillaume Boudet, who lived from 1467 to 1540, pictured the king as almost a divine figure. He said, you know, the king is really God on earth, and we have to obey him. So we see, we have in this period kind of a general increase in writers who were emphasizing the power of the king, the power of the absolute state. The most famous 16th century defender of government power was Machiavelli. He argued in the, his most famous work, The Prince, that the ruler doesn't have to observe moral restraint. He said the ruler should do whatever was needed to gain and keep power. And he should be deceitful, should have pretend to be virtuous, even if he isn't. So he might want to acquire a reputation as a good person, but if he really needed to do something bad to keep power, he should do that. I remember, those of you studying history of philosophy, remember in Plato's Republic, there's a famous discussion where Socrates is talking to Glaucon and Thrasymachus, and the question comes up, is it better to be really good where people are thinking you're bad, or is it really better to be bad and just have people thinking you're good? So Machiavelli is firmly on the side, it's really better to be, for the prince to be bad and have people think he's good. So according to Rothbard, this makes Machiavelli a creature of evil. Now, Quentin Skinner, who is a key source for Rothbard's account of Machiavelli, remember Skinner wrote that two-volume book that I mentioned, I think, in my first lecture, Foundations of Modern Political Thought. Rothbard thought extremely highly of this book. Now, Rothbard has gotten a lot of his account of what Machiavelli was saying from Skinner, but Skinner denied that Machiavelli was a creature of evil. And what was his argument? He said, well, Machiavelli didn't favor doing evil for its own sake. He wasn't like Satan in Milton's Paradise Lost, who said, evil, be thou my good. But I'm saying evil is, you should do evil because that's really great, you're able to do evil. He said, the Machiavelli thought the prince should use evil measures only if necessary. If possible, the prince should really be good, just that Machiavelli thought in practice the prince won't be able to really be good, because if he wants to gain and keep power, he won't be able to do that. But Rothbard, and I quote this because it's kind of characteristic, amusing passage from Rothbard, gives you a sense of his style. He says, well, that just is what Skinner says is Machiavelli's position, is just to be a creature of evil. He said, Professor Skinner, however, has a curious view of what preaching evil might really be. Who in the history of the world, after all, and outside of Dr. Fu Manchu novel, that was a famous series of novels by this evil person who was involved in all sorts of plots, who outside of Fu Manchu novel is actually lauding evil per se and counseling evil and vice at every step of life's way. So I say, well, Skinner's defense of Machiavelli really makes the point that he really was a teacher of evil. And he said, preaching evil, with still quoting Rothbard, he says, preaching evil is a counsel precisely as Machiavelli has done. Be good so long as goodness doesn't get in the way of something you want. In the case of the ruler, that's something you need, the maintenance and expansion of power. What else could such flexibility in the preaching of evil be all about? Now, I'll just close with another key theme in Rothbard's book. And this is going to be very important in his discussion of Marx, and we won't be able to get to that in this class, because that's in Volume 2, is that one source of communism, one sort of view that we should share everything in common, is a mystical doctrine that stems from the Calabrian abbot, Joachim of Fiore, sometimes called Joachim of Flora, with 1145-1202. He argued that history really consists of three stages. You know, this is became very famous in later theories. You have three stages in history. August Comte had that. So Joachim had this three-stage theory. And the third age, which is the final one, is the age of the Holy Spirit. And in this third age, people would be totally liberated. Now, Rothbard thinks that through a Czech group called the Taborites, the Joachimite doctrines had an influence on the Anabaptist revolt of Thomas Münzer and the communist uprising in Munster. These were ones that Rothbard discusses in quite some detail in the chapter. People were just kind of going in and saying, we've got to get rid of all these explorers, we have to have everything in common. And they led to very bad outcomes, as Rothbard describes. So one of the key themes that comes out, especially in the discussion, the later discussion of Marx, is that this influence of Joachim of Flora. Now, three books that I'll just finish with that influenced Rothbard a great deal. First, a book by Ronald Knox, Senior Ronald Knox, a famous Catholic, English Catholic priest, who's actually a convert from the Anglican, called Enthusiasm. And Enthusiasm, he wasn't enthusiastic, but enthusiasm means kind of being dominated by the emotions in religious movement. So, as Bishop Joseph Butler said to John Wesley, that enthusiasm is a very horrid thing. This was the attitude of Knox, and Rothbard takes us over. That people were emotionally gripped by this kind of pseudo-mystical notion that they were in the last stage of history. In another book that emphasizes, discusses the Anabaptist revolt that Rothbard has been very influenced by, Norman Cohn, The Pursuit of the Millennium. And the final one was, I want to mention, by Eric Vogler, who stressed a lot the influence of Joachim of Fiore on later movements, later theories of history, in this book, New Science of Politics, which I think came out in 1952. So I think those, if you're interested in this aspect of Rothbard's views, those were three very good books you might want to look at. Okay, so I think I've gone a bit over time, so I think we'll will stop now, and I'm now going to the Q&A box, so if you have any questions, please type them in there. Now let's see, let me just put this aside. Ryan said, when trying to grab as much as you can, run into merchants. Well, I think this is really getting, it is a similar attitude that we'll find in emergencies. Yes, I mean, that's what emergencies were trying to do, as we'll see in the next lecture. They said the country should just try to accumulate as much money as possible. And they had the view that trade was really, if you're not a mutually beneficial exchange. And Philip said, you touch on the answer, please expand. Here, Rothbard seems to be an apologist for the Catholic Church, whom we call Frank Knight a vehement anti-Catholic and didn't back up his claim. Is not Rothbard biased? When he said Frank Knight was a vehement anti-Catholic, I mean, he didn't, I don't know specifically what he said in the passage you're referring to, but I mean, it was quite well known. Frank Knight made no secret that he was very anti-Catholic. If you look at they had an essay reviewing the Catholic philosopher Jacques Maritain, was extremely hostile to Catholic natural law. It's not a controversial point that Knight was very critical of Catholicism. And in fact, the story goes when he taught at the University of Chicago, if he saw a Catholic priest in the audience in his classes, he would just start giving criticism to the church till they got up and left. Now, you ask, is not Rothbard biased? Well, here we want to make it's a very good question. We want to make an important distinction between having a point of view, which he certainly Rothbard has, he's certainly very pro-Catholic, although as I said, he's not a believer in Catholicism, but he's certainly an admirer of the Catholic Church in that period. And sometimes when we say someone is biased, that suggests that because they have a point of view, that this is distorting their grasp of something. So say, well, this person is biased, he's not really interpreting the evidence so that he's coming up with truth, he's just kind of blinded or at least not seeing things properly because of his view. And to say that someone has a particular point of view, it doesn't follow that they're biased. If you wanted to argue that, you have to say, well, here's why what Rothbard is saying is wrong. It wouldn't be sufficient just to say, well, look, he's very pro-Catholic, so he's biased, so we can really have to take what he says with skepticism. You have to show there's something wrong with what he said. Now, Khalil said, can you say more about the role religion played in previous issues of economic thought? Our novel was Rothbard in this respect. Well, I think you'll find, say, in Schumpeter's History of Economic Analysis, you'll find quite a bit of discussion of Scholasticism. But most of the histories of economic thought, I think you'll find even today, they're pretty much confined to history of economics. Say, just like, say, if you read a history of physics, what you're going to be getting is a discussion of physics, not of what's going on in other areas of culture or other subjects. So most history of economics would be just confined to pretty strictly to developments in economic theory. But Rothbard is giving you a whole cultural and intellectual background, so I think it's quite different. So Phil said, okay, I didn't know this about Nine, thank you for the distinction of bias and point of view. Well, I mean, since you're agreeing with me, you're obviously right. If you're seeing things my way, that's the way to go. I both have a point of view and bias on that. Justin says, Rockwart is very critical of Luther, but slightly less so of Calvin. Is that the same view as the Catholics, interest you mentioned earlier? Well, I think the Catholic views, the Catholic writers tend to write more on Luther than Calvin. They were quite negative on Calvin as a theologian also, but the particular writers I mentioned were Gnefel and Grisart, tended to write on Luther more. But I think the reason he's somewhat less critical of Calvin, I think, is that Calvin took economics more seriously than Luther did. He had things to say about interest, that taking interest that Rothbard thinks are worthy of some comment, but he's very dismissive of Luther. And I should say, when I mention that people take different interpretations of Luther and Calvin from that of Rothbard, there's some people say, well, Luther and Calvin didn't reject natural law altogether. There's such a thing as Protestant scholasticism. Rothbard himself recognizes that for some of the later figures, but he does tend to think Luther and Calvin were pretty rationalist. So what I'm trying to do in this lecture, I think Rothbard is an extremely important and significant figure. So I'm trying to give you his interpretation of things rather than try to offer some kind of criticism from an independent point of view. I'm trying to give you what is it that Rothbard is saying, so we can understand his views both on economic theory and what's going on in this period in other disciplines or other subjects. The Gnefels have a strong opinion of Weber's view of Calvinism. That's an excellent question, but I don't think he wrote that much about it. I think he discusses Christianity to some extent in his book Socialism, but I don't think in that section he said much. He mentions Weber on Calvinism. Mises tended to be a bit critical of Christian doctrine, the influence of Christian doctrine, but I don't think he specifically commented on the Max Weber theory. It's a very good question, but I can look that up and see if I can come up with anything. Danny, do you know any passage in Mises that discusses Weber on Calvinism? I can't think of any offhand, but my mind is probably failing me, as it often does. Yes, I'll see what I can. I don't think. I'm not remembering any place to discuss it there. Let me just see if anybody's got anything in the chat also. Did Rothbard intend to discuss 1803 in opposition to absolutist theory of the period? Well, of course, you know, he does discuss Blavatsky in his introduction to the translation of Discourse on Voluntary Servitude. I don't know why he didn't mention him in this chapter, especially since Montaigne was a great friend of Blavatsky. So I don't really know why he didn't discuss him in this chapter. Oh, now somebody said, Justin, I missed one. What do you think of Strauss's view of Machiavelli? Well, Strauss wrote a famous book called Thoughts on Machiavelli, where he also says, like Rothbard, says Machiavelli was a teacher of evil, but it's not clear that's the ostensible thing he's saying, but he's not clear that's what he, the real thesis. But what Strauss seems to be stressing more is that Machiavelli was an opponent of Christianity, was trying to view himself as someone who's kind of creating a new system of things where philosophers such as himself would really be the advisors of the rulers and really in a position to promote progress. So he views Machiavelli as kind of the origins of the modern world. I think it's an extremely interesting view of Machiavelli based on very careful study. You should read, it's available on the Mises website, Rothbard's review of Strauss. Rothbard kind of makes fun of certain aspects of the book. Strauss thinks there's all these kind of numerological coincidences, things like the number of chapters in a particular book has some significance and has all sorts of numerical patterns. So we should look at Rothbard's view. Another said, to what extent did the Montaigne fallacy influence Marx? Well, I don't think that you could say he had the view that he, you could say his view, I suppose, of how wage labor under capitalism is an example of the fallacy, because Marx is saying that it isn't a mutually beneficial exchange between the worker and capitalist. Really, the capitalist is exploiting the worker because the capitalist is in control of the means of production, so he's really getting part of the worker's product because the worker has to come to him in order to produce anything. So I think you could say the fallacy is present in what he says about labor exploitation. That's a very good question, as I haven't thought of that, but it's a good point you asked. Let's see, does anybody have anything in the chat or also? Let's see what else we have. Okay, that's there. Okay, we still have some time for somebody said the name of the chat. Okay, good. Justin, what are you thinking of your own comes to Super Millennium? I think it's a very good book, you know, on discussing these messianic sects. He's very influenced by psychoanalysis, and if you somewhat critical of that, I mean, that would possibly be a weakness of the book. But it was a work that both Rothbard and Eric Vogelin thought very highly of. So I think it's very much one worth reading. Roman Cohn is a very important thinker. He had a very interesting book also on the anti-Semitism and the protocols of Zion, an interpretation of that also, but Pursuing Lenin is certainly an important book. It's definitely worth reading. I remember it came out as a paperback published by Harper many years ago. You used to be able to buy books very cheaply in the old days. Justin, Raymond Walter asked a question in the chatter. I don't think you got it. Okay, well, let's go back. I'm sorry. Sorry, Raymond. Let's go back to the chat. Wait a sec. I don't see anything. Are you sure it's in the chat? I don't see anything from Raymond there. Wait a sec. Let's have another look. No, I'm not. Raymond, if you're still there, could you put the question in? I'm not seeing the entries. I'm not seeing it. I went and just looked at the chat and I didn't see anything from Raymond. Let me just check the chats one more time. Good evening, Tuesday works. Yeah. Oh, no, the only thing I see one from Justin, I see one from you that I didn't get to. Oh, that was Raymond's question. Oh, okay. I see. My impression was that Vader's early writings on the rise of Capitalism, which I've read in part, were not over insights of Old Crossing. Going into later book, which I've not read, made the series, my impression correct. Well, that's a very good question. What Weber did in some of his other work, he never said that Protestantism is the exclusive cause of the rise of capitalism. And he put this as part of a general theory of the modern world is one of kind of a rise of the rational, calculating intellect. And he put that He traced that in other works, just sort of get kind of a general rise of this rational, calculating intellect. So he put this is just one aspect, the Protestant ethics theory is just one aspect of kind of a general account of the origins of the modern world. So it's not that he said, I think his theory, Protestant ethics, is consistent with what he said in his other books, but it's just one aspect of it. So I think you're right, he doesn't stress that as much in his other works, but he's being consistent with what he said earlier, not radically revising his earlier books. Now it's possible somebody could certainly think, well, Weber's right about this general rise of rationalism, but wrong about the influence of the Protestant ethics. That's certainly a point of view one could take, but it's not, I think, the one that Weber himself takes. Oh, good. I'm glad we finally figured out, got to Raymond's question. I know Raymond always has good points, so I didn't want to miss what he said. Justin, the Rothbard, a fan of John Donne. I don't recall that he mentioned John Donne. Now, I think he did like the literary critic Ivor Winters, who was somewhat favorable to John Donne, but I don't recall him ever mentioning John Donne. He does say something about John Donne there, but I don't recall him discussing Donne as a poet very much, but you're right, he does mention in the chapter quite right. Incidentally, you know, some people, when they're talking about a metaphor, you know, we have a theory of metaphor, I'll say, well, a metaphor is something, one of the requirements of metaphor is that it isn't literally true. They probably say, this person is a lion in controversy, so, well, the person isn't, it's a metaphor, the person really isn't a lion. But you can use the famous line from John Donne as a counter into that, when he said, no man is an island, it's a metaphor, but it's literally true that no man is an island. Okay, look in the chat. Look in the chat, we have something. I think we already, was that in reference to Raymond's question? I think we already, here it is. Could you recommend a good book on the rise of capitalism in the early city state? Well, I think historian Robert Solano Lopez, Robert Lopez did something on that years ago. I think he would be a good one to look at. Robert Solano Lopez, I think that's one who's coming to mind right now. Carlo Cipolla is one also. Let me see if I could, I'll just type those in here. We'll put these in the chat. Those would be ones I think you could look up those names. You'll find books on the rise of capitalism, Italian city-states. Okay, well, I guess we're about out of time now, so I hope we'll see you all next week. Thanks for coming. Thank you, everybody. Bye, everybody.